3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, everyone. You are tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And if it sounds a little bit different to the past few weeks, that's right, it is, because we are back live in the studio. That's right, we are back for 2026. Happy New Year, everyone, if you're following the Gregorian calendar. I hope that you have had a not too stressful past couple of weeks, that you've been, locked in 855 on your AM dial to 3CR, because there's been plenty of incredible summer programming, not least our recap of the highlights of 2025 on Thursday Breakfast. And of course, we are at an extremely busy point in the year. Next week, next Monday, is Invasion Day. There's a lot of preparation leading up to that, and we're going to be talking a bit about that on today's show. And so let's just jump into what we've got on. This morning, we are going to be joined first by Tarneen Onus-Brown, Gunajamara Yorta Yorta Bindle and Merriam person and community organizer, to discuss the ongoing federal court challenge against Victoria Police's designated areas powers in the context of First Nations resistance movements. Now, this is a case brought by Human Rights Law Centre on behalf of Tarneen, Benny Zabel and a new applicant, David Hack, which questions the validity of Victoria Police's extraordinary powers within designated areas, including stop and search powers and the ability to direct people to leave areas if they refuse to remove a face covering. After that, we'll be joined by Paul Silva, who is a Dungari activist and nephew of David Dungai Jr., who speaks with us about the importance of public resistance gatherings led by First Nations people and the upcoming Invasion Day rally in Sydney, which is anticipated to proceed without heightened policing because of a last-minute exemption to New South Wales' increasingly draconian protest laws. So Paul is going to talk with us about a rally held last Sunday, the 18th of January, that commemorated 10 years since David Dungai Jr. passed away in the custody of New South Wales Corrective Services, and how this was met with quite a significant police presence because of expanded protest policing laws granted after the Bondi attack in December 2025. After that, and I think you might be able to sense a bit of a theme here, Ilo Diaz from the Center Against Racial Profiling joins us again to continue the discussion that we started last year about designated area declarations in Victoria. And he's going to be speaking about the report, A Tale of Two Cities, The Hidden Geography of Police Powers in Victoria, which was released this week by the Centre, and it identifies the racialized impact of designated area policing via an analysis of declarations by Victoria Police between 2019 and 2024. And finally, earlier this week, Alice caught up with writer, independent journalist and anti-fascist activist Tom Tanaki to discuss the Labor government's combating anti-Semitism laws, much of which have passed both houses of Parliament earlier this week. And of course, civil society organizations and legal advocates have been raising alarm about the speed at which these laws have been rushed through Parliament, with consultation on the exposure draft of the Combating Anti-Semitism, Hate and Extremism Bill 2026 announced on the 13th of January this year in the wake of the Bondi attack. So this is going to be a packed show, hopefully a very informative show. Hopefully it'll leave you charged up to keep challenging injustice and to keep fighting to hang on to the, you know, meager, shrinking protections that we have to exercise our rights to protest, to raise our voices against injustice and to take to the streets. So stay tuned to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:05 in the morning and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Hi,
Hi,
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
VCR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 22nd of January. The Albanese Labor government's hate speech laws passed the Senate this week in a late-night vote after the bill was rushed through Parliament in response to the Bondi attack, drawing criticism over lack of scrutiny and the speed of its passage. Advocacy groups, including Free Palestine Melbourne and the Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, warn the laws give ministers sweeping powers to ban organisations and could criminalise legitimate political speech, protest and artistic expression. The Greens have also opposed the bill, saying it will have a chilling effect on public debate and expand state power in ways that threaten fundamental rights. In other news, a new study has found racialized communities in Victoria are subjected to warrantless police searches up to 3.5 times more often than white majority areas, despite some areas that are white majority recording higher crime rates. The report by the Centre Against Racial Profiling analysed all designated area declarations issued by Victoria Police between 2019 and 2024. The data shows these police powers are overwhelmingly used at everyday locations like train stations and shopping centres and yield contraband in just 1% of searches. The findings point to a two-tiered policing system in which ineffective search powers are disproportionately imposed on racialised communities, while affluent white areas are largely spared. Also in news this week, Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe will move an amendment to the federal government's new gun control laws, calling for police and prison service firearms to be included in national tracking and oversight systems, arguing accountability must extend beyond civilian use of weapons. Senator Thorpe said excluding law enforcement armories from national registers leaves dangerous transparency gaps, citing recent thefts of police firearms in so-called Australia and evidence from international examples that lead that weak oversight allows weapons to leak into criminal markets. Finally, in headlines this week, healthcare workers' union members walked off the job and rallied at Trades Hall before marching to the Premier's office in NARM this week, demanding a fair pay deal that keeps pace with the cost of living. The state government's refusal to deliver an above-inflation pay rise will result in 1 in 4 hospital beds being closed until February, as rolling work bans continue as part of union action. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 22nd of January, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. Now, a couple of community announcements about upcoming events. Of course, we have Invasion Day coming up on Monday, the 26th of January. And remember that you can tune into 3CR 855 AM to listen to speeches live from the rally. But if you do plan to attend, and we really encourage you to get on the streets, it will be Monday, 11 a.m. at Victoria's Parliament. So meeting at 11 a.m. Monday at Victoria's Parliament on Spring Street. We will be broadcasting speeches live from the rally on 3CR 855 AM from 11 AM, as well as having dedicated First Nations programming across the day. So make sure to stay tuned from first thing in the morning on Monday, and we will be taking you through Invasion Day rallies, as well as some special interviews and segments with First Nations programmers. And also, we wanted to remind you about the fun run for Mutual Aid, which is happening at Footscray Park from 9 a.m. on the 1st of February, with funds split evenly between First Nations, Palestinian and Sudanese initiatives, and with food by We Eat and Good. So this is free to join, and people basically raise sponsorships to run by registering to walk, run, or ride and gather funds for Mutual Aid. There's going to be a bake sale, market stalls, massages, a raffle, and speeches. And to find out more and to register, because you've still got time, head to Fun Run 4, Mutual Aid on Instagram. So that's Fun Run for Mutual Aid on Instagram. And you'll have all of the information there, all of your questions answered, and access information and COVID safety information as well. So again, you're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Disasters like flood, fire, and extreme heat can have a significant impact on people's lives. Community legal centres help people experiencing challenges posed by climate change and disasters to access the resources and support they need. Disasters can lead to a range of problems, such as damage to your home, poor conditions with your rental home, difficulty getting insurance, issues within families, at work, and with Centrelink payments. Community legal centres can be found across Victoria and can provide help if you've been affected by a disaster. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres website at fclc.org.au. You can also contact Disaster Legal Help Victoria on 1800 113 432 and go to its website for helpful information at disasterlegalhelp.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are now joined by Tarneen Onis-Brown, Gunajamara Yorta Yorta Bindle and Mariam person and community organizer, who is speaking with us about the ongoing federal court challenge against Victoria Police's designated area powers in the context of First Nations resistance movements. This case, brought by Human Rights Law Centre on behalf of Tarneen, Benny Zabel, and with new applicant David Hack, questions the validity of Victoria Police's extraordinary powers within designated areas, which includes stop and search powers and the ability to direct people to leave areas if they refuse to remove a face covering. While the 6-month declaration of NARM CBD as a designated area was ended early, organizers are still concerned about the impact that ever-expanding police powers will have on fundamental protest rights, particularly those of First Nations people in the lead-up to Invasion Day 2026. Good morning, Tarneen.
Good morning, Priya. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Now, you are one of the lead applicants in this legal challenge in federal court against Victoria Police's designated area powers. But I understand that the initial six-month designated area that was announced last year across the CBD was actually brought to an end earlier this month. So why have you decided to continue the challenge?
Yeah, so it did come to an end on Friday the 8th or 9th, I think it was. And we still decided to go ahead because we know that Victoria Police have said that they would make another designation for Invasion Day. And we know that it affects First Nations people and our allies that would be attending the Invasion Day rally. And we want to make sure that people aren't stopped and searched and harassed by police. And so that's why we are continuing, that's why we continue to challenge the case and hopefully have an answer this week.
Yeah, because it's supposed to come to an end tomorrow, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I wanted to sort of zoom out to ask you about how you've seen the policing of Invasion Day rallies change over time. You know, what was it like when you first started attending January 26th protests? And have you seen things develop across your own time as an organizer?
Yeah, well, it's funny. Like, in 2015, at the first Invasion Day rally that war organised, I had actually gotten into, like, a police officer had, like, grabbed my Aboriginal flag. Off me and, like, we're pulling at it at both ends because it was, like, on a pole. And, you know, there was, like, a couple of thousand people at that time. And it's not the type of attacks you'd kind of see on people now because we're, like, there's so many of us, right? Mm. And the police presence at Invasion Day, like, changes quite a lot. I don't know what it depends on, like, but sometimes it changes from, like, not a few police to police on horses. We haven't had it as a designated area before, which we, like, when the designation was going for 6 months, we wanted to make sure that it wasn't going to be a designated area on Invasion Day because we haven't had that before. But, yeah, it kind of just changes, I think, also depending on, like, the type of information police get as well. Like, obviously, we've had, you know, people make up lies about us and what we intend to do as organisers and have nearly had our houses raided, those sorts of things. So, yeah, it's like it's really difficult to manage and deal with, like, the police and, like, how they treat us and people who participate as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm glad that you mentioned, you know, this sort of threat as well of police intervening in your lives outside of the space of the rally too, because I think that it's really important that we capture the sort of broad scope of police intervention that accompanies these vital, you know, moments of resistance. And I remember, you know, a few years ago when the police were like, oh, we can't have the sound truck. And so then, you know, broadcasting speeches was not possible within the rally. And that felt very arbitrary. So, yeah, as you said, these things sort of, like, change over time and different policing tactics change over time. But I did want to also ask you about the importance of getting out on the streets on Invasion Day. Why are these public gatherings of mourning and resistance so significant?
I think it's really significant because it's a moment where First Nations people get to, like, talk about the truth of this country and the violence and the out-of-cell experiences that people like to really sweep under the rug, the government and others. So it is important that we get to stand up and, like, show our strength. I think First Nations people were spoken about in, like, quite a paternalistic way, and this is our way of showing, like, the strength that we have as Blackfellas. And it's just been really, like, deadly to see the, like, organisers grow, you know, even outside of Melbourne and, like, the major cities, to having people organising Invasion Day events in Cairns, in Hamilton, in Portland, and in other areas as well, that this is a moment where people get to show up in their own communities, in regional areas, to talk about the truth of this country and the violence of this place, but also how Aboriginal people were speaking up and taking action against it as well.
Yeah, and that reclamation of space and, like, being able to set the narrative, I think, is such a vital part of these rallies. And, you know, being out on the street, being in public, it is meant to be a disruption of business as usual. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about your plans for Invasion Day 2026?
Yeah, so we are, the rally will be on Monday, the 26th of January, 11 a.m, and we'll have speakers and some performers on the day, marching down Bourke Street, just our usual route, turning left at Swanston and going down to Flinders Street and sitting in. It is going to be a hot day, so we really want to encourage people to, like, make sure that they hydrate the day before and on the day, wear sunscreen, hat, flip-flop, slap situation. It's just been, like, really excited to see the banners, to be honest, on the day as well, because we've had, like, I think maybe 10 banner-making workshops.
Yeah, there's so many.
And we used to have, like, one or two. So I'm really excited to see all the banners that people have made, and just, like, the keenness of people to gather in preparation to be creative and just, like, be together and shared values. It's just, like, really nice, and hopefully there'll be heaps out in the street this Invasion Day.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be incredible. And, I mean, just to wrap up, do you have any messages you'd like to share with our audience, including any calls for volunteer support on the day for anything else that needs getting done to make sure that it all comes off in the best way possible?
Yeah, I think there's, like, a few things. We are going to be sending out, like, health information to people's emails. So if people do want to receive those, to sign up to the Humanitics, like, event page. So we'll be sending out health information there through to people's emails. We also need some volunteers for marshals, and also Dajua needs volunteers to collect money as well, and donations. So if people are keen to, yeah, put their hand up to do some donation collection, marshalling, and to get people to sign up for the Humanitics, so we can send through health information and legal information. Mm-hmm. Because depending on whether the police make a declaration on Invasion Day, we can update people about their legal rights as well.
Sure. Okay. So is the best place to go for all of that information WAR's Instagram? Is that where you'll be posting everything?
Because the algorithm of Meta, mm-hmm. it's really difficult to
beat the algorithm. It's like a lot of people being shadow banned, all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So my advice is to sign up for the Humanitics so that you can get information into an email inbox.
Yes.
So that we can communicate with you directly, because Instagram, like obviously you can go over to our Instagram page, but we rely so much on the algorithm to show us what we need to, and so we're trying to beat big tech.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And get directly to people. So we'll chuck a link in our show notes to the Humanitics and encourage people to sign up and show up. And Tarneen, I'll see you. I'll be doing the 3CR soundstage on the day. So I'll see you on Monday.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Priya. I'll see you on Monday.
See ya. And that was Tarneen Onus-Brown, Gunjamara Yorta Yorta Bindle, and Mariam Person, community organizer, who spoke with us about the ongoing federal court challenge against Victoria Police's designated area powers in the context of First Nations resistance movements and upcoming Invasion Day rally on Monday. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:26 in the morning.
Monday, the 26th of January, marks Invasion Day, and 3CR's First Nations broadcast team will be bringing an annual Invasion Day broadcast to the airwaves from 10 a.m.
In 1788, down Sydney Cove, first boat people land, and they say, sorry boys, I gained your loss, we're gonna steal your land.
Our team will be broadcasting speeches from the NAM rally and conversations with people attending the march, as well as connecting with Aboriginal activists from across the continent at the forefront of campaigns for land rights, restoration, restitution, and real treaties, and learning about the way it may be done. And of course, we'll be playing deadly music from our incredible black artists, past and present. So keep it tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., 3CR Digital, 3CR.org.au streaming live on Monday, the 26th of January from 10 a.m.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we gonna move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1pm.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You are tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. A quick little switch up. We are now going to be joined by Ilo Diaz from the Center Against Racial Profiling, which I'm also a member of, to continue the discussion about designated areas declarations in Victoria. So following from our conversation on the 18th of December last year, where Ilo spoke about some of the work he's been doing to document designated areas, today's interview focuses on the report A Tale of Two Cities, the Hidden Geography of Police Powers in Victoria, which was released this week by the Centre and which identifies the racialized impact of designated area policing via an analysis of declarations between 2019 and 2024. We will have a link to A Tale of Two Cities in our show notes, but for now, good morning, Ilo.
Good morning, Priya.
How's it going?
Yeah, good.
Thanks very much for coming back on. I know we had you on pretty recently to talk about the designated areas federal court challenge brought by Human Rights Law Centre against Victoria Police. But can you give our listeners a brief recap of what designated areas powers enable police to do and what happened with that, that 6 month designated area?
Sure. Yeah. And thanks for having me on again. Designated areas, sure your listeners are already across, but I'll remind everyone that they are like an overreach of power the police have. So usually when you walk down the street, you have the right to not be searched for absolutely no reason, so privacy, and not be detained, so not to be stopped. These are all rights that we have when we walk down on any given street. In designated areas, those rights are taken away. And so police can stop you for absolutely no reason and search you. They come with other powers, like forcing you to leave that area or demasking you, so forcing you to take your mask off. But essentially, it's a search power, along with and they've tacked on other powers to it. So it's a very, very invasive and very powerful piece of legislation or police power that they have access to.
Mm. Yeah, and they did announce Victoria Police a 6 month designated area, which caused a lot of alarm at the end of last year. But now I understand that, you know, and we discussed in the chat that I just had with Tarneen, that it came to an end quite early. What happened there?
Yeah, look, police last year declared the CBD a 6 month long designated area. It's the first one we've seen that has been in place for that long. We know those powers came into place late last year of allowing police to designate an area for up to 6 months, and shortly after that they did. We heard earlier this month that they rescinded that 6 month long designated area, but they have indicated that they are still thinking of applying another designated area, maybe for lesser time. And the reasons behind it is, of course, everything with Victoria Police, it's a guessing game. We don't know. They like to hide behind their, secrecy of police intel and whatnot. And so it's hard to know exactly why they've stopped that designated area, but, it must... We all think it's got to be related with the court case that came, that Human Rights Law Centre and Tarneen and Benny and others brought against Victoria Police on that specific designated area. If that will have impact on the outcome of the court case, we're yet to find out. I do believe the findings will be coming down either on Friday, either Friday or today.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, as we were able to discuss with Tarneen as well, there's still so many concerns just related to the designated area powers in general that warrant a challenge. So it'll be very, very instructive to see what the decision is when it's handed down. Now, the Centre Against Racial Profiling just published your A Tale of Two Cities report on the racialized impact of designated areas policing, where you characterize a tactic of discretionary policing that you call hub-based policing. Can you talk about what this means?
Yeah, so hub-based policing is a term we use to describe to differentiate the types of designated areas. In the study, I've identified essentially two main designated areas, or the rationale for using a designated area. One is event based. So these are designated areas that have been declared because of some sort of event. So think about Moomba, New Year's, or a protest, or something that would bring external crowds into an area, right? Then there's hub-based policing, hub-based designated areas, which is what I've used to describe designated areas that are declared where people live, work, and commute through. So shopping centres, train stations, high streets, these kind of entertainment precincts, these kind of places. These are not targeted at crowds or people coming from an external event. These are targeting the community themselves. And so that's what hub-based policing or hub-based designated areas are. Mm. They're conscious targeting of community infrastructure that create bottlenecks where communities must use or often use. So they're doing their shopping, they're going out, they're catching a bus, catching a train. And so they almost necessarily need to pass through these areas. And these are the spaces where designated areas are declared.
Yeah, and I think, the fact that you have distinguished this from event-based policing, where, there's a dedicated amount of time for an event, there's some sort of theme where this is just looking at concentrations of people, in the sort of geographies of their daily lives. I think it's really revealing to see, what this sort of spatial tactic of policing, shows about who is targeted and the intensity at which people are targeted in particular communities. And I wanted to ask how you identified the racial dynamics of hub-based policing that you describe in the report. So what did you do to identify racialized communities and assess the sort of intensity of policing they experience? And what does that tell us about the use of designated areas powers?
Yeah, I mean, that's really a great question, Priya. Look, I think I need to make it really clear to everyone that race, just like crime, is a social construct. And so when I started this study, there was a lot of ethical questions around race and how to essentially measure an LGA's racial makeup, racialization. These are all social constructs. Like, the race is not a real thing. It's not a biological fact. The impact of race is real. Racism is still real, but the biological facts of race are not true. So, with that caveat, what this study is trying to do is trying to reverse engineer the way that Victoria Police sees community. So we're trying to scrape the surface of how police see us and see racialized communities compared to white communities. And so therefore, we need to define what is a racialized community. So as a long way to get to your question, this study puts that Victoria Police are racialized communities. So while, when they go into a community and they see who lives in these areas, that's how these areas become racialized. The study looked at the only way we can really get a kind of a grasp of what, how this happens and how it might be happening within Victoria Police is to look at ancestry data. And so what we did was we went into census data, we took out all the ancestry data and we applied it to the LGA. So every non-European ancestry is considered racialized, European considered racialized. Now, this is really, it's a really blunt instrument. It's not very sophisticated because we can't, we know that some European ancestries are racialized by police. We know that. And we know that some non-European ancestries are not racialized, right? But as a way to kind of get an idea of how this works, we use this instrument. That really pulled up a lot of really interesting data. For example, Dandenong versus Yarra. You know, the city of Dandenong has about like 67% of the population are racialized, whereas Yarra is about 16%, and they have similar crime rates. Yet Dandenong gets much more hub-based designated areas than Yarra.
Mm.
Yarra gets none, right? So when we apply this layer, this kind of logic, this racialized logic that we're trying to reverse engineer, that is police logic, we get to see these like massive disproportionality rates across the state.
Yeah, I mean, like what you're mapping really is, you know, power relations here and how people experience these arbitrary interventions into their lives by Victoria Police. And it really paints quite a stark picture. Now, I was wondering if there's anything else from the report that you wanted to mention that's really stood out to you, anything you haven't been able to discuss since the release that you think deserves our attention?
I mean, I think the report, there's so much to say. There's so much that has come out. For example, designated areas. It's a growing trend since 2019 to 2024, which is the range of the study. Designated areas have grown, and there've been more and more announced. And I've been keeping track of 2025. While it's not in the official data of the report, we have been keeping an eye on it. And again, there are more designated areas in 2025 than there were in 2024. And, you know, and I'm sure it will keep growing. So there's a reliance on designated areas from VicPol, all right? The other thing, you know, I'll mention to your listeners is that this study also really showed how whiteness and affluence is a protective factor. So not every single LGA or shopping centre or train station gets a designated area. There's only a few, and those are mostly where racialized communities live. And so what we see is not just who gets targeted, but it's who doesn't get targeted, who gets protected from these powers. And it's mostly affluent and white communities. I've put in affluent in there because there's a big asterisk I need to let your listeners know, is that Geelong is actually an outlier in all of this, because Geelong is not heavily racialized, but is also very, very heavily policed. It is one of the areas that they get many, many designated areas, mostly around its high streets and its shopping centers. But it is very low on the socioeconomic status.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the study says is a complicated picture, right? It's saying race predicts where designated areas are going to be. Crime does not predict that. But poverty can. Poverty can predict this, but race amplifies it.
Mm.
And so it's a really important caveat to say race and poverty or socioeconomic status, they go together. A poor LGA can get designated areas. If it's racialized, even more so.
Mm. Yeah.
But what we don't see is any affluent areas getting designated areas. That is something we do not see.
Yeah, it's this, you know, you're looking at trends in criminalization of these, you know, aspects of people's lives, whether they are racialized in relation to whiteness, whether they are, you know, whether poverty is being criminalized, and I think there's so much more, you know, fine grained analysis that can be done about this. But I think the overall picture that you've painted really shows quite a disparity in the level of interference in people's lives if they live in communities that are highly racialized. And I just wanted to bring it back to the court case that is wrapping up this week. Now, can you tell us about where things are at in the case and what to look out for as it draws to a close? What will you be looking out for?
Yeah, my understanding is that the judge will come out with a ruling by the end of the week, so either today or tomorrow. So we'll keep an eye out on that. I'll be looking out for any findings that the judge is making around the length of time which police. So the crux of it is that police need to justify these designated areas. They need to say that there's been some sort of crime or crime with a weapon in the last 12 months, and that then justifies a designated area in some cases. What will be interesting from this ruling to see what comes out of it is to see how much, quote-unquote, police intel is needed for it to justify a six-month-long or 3 months or however long designated area. Like, what is the threshold between police intel that there's been crime? How much crime does it need for them to then just declare a 6 month long? Is it one? Is it two? Is it how many incidents with a weapon needs to have happened in that area for it to justify a designated area? I think that's something that would be very interesting to see if there's anything that comes out of that, because I think that's a question we've been asking the whole time, is these designated areas are so secretive, and we don't know the reasons as to why, really. We don't know why they declare which area. This study is, you know, the study I made is an attempt to explain it, because crime is not explaining that,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, crime doesn't explain it. And so what is the explanation on this? So that'll be something I'll keep an eye out. And just to finish off, to say that, you know, this is just systemic racism in Victoria Police, right? This is how it manifests. This is just another way in which we're trying to track it. And whether it's a good thing to track it or not, I think it's important that that communities know what's happening there, because I think before we started tracking these areas, designated areas mostly came in under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
They were only really announced when it was around a protest. And I think it's systemic racism, because it mostly happens actually in suburbs and LGAs where racialized communities live. This is how Victoria Police systemically entrench racism in their policing and operations. It's every day. It's not just at a protest. It's every day. Every day these things are happening. So, I just wanted to reiterate that point.
Yeah. I mean, it is definitely something that I'll be looking for in terms of the justification that is provided to create designated areas, because I think that'll be another piece of information that will help the community just interpret the way that police are intervening in their lives. These are all tools to help us better understand what is happening to us so that we can figure out how to challenge and resist these power dynamics and the policing of our communities. And Ilo, you've been doing really vital work in this regard. So thank you very much. And thanks for joining us.
No, thank you so much.
And that was Ilo Diaz from the Center Against Racial Profiling, who joined us to continue our discussion about designated area declarations in Victoria and to speak about the report, A Tale of Two Cities, The Hidden Geography of Police Powers in Victoria, which was released this week and identifies the racialized impact of designated area policing via an analysis of declarations between 2019 and 2024. And we will have a link to that report in our show notes. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM and it is 7:49 in the morning.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you are currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And if you're just joining us, first up on the show today, we were joined by Tarneen Onis-Brown to discuss the ongoing federal court challenge against Victoria Police's designated areas powers in the context of First Nations resistance movements. And that was followed by a chat with Ilo Diaz from the Centre Against Racial Profiling, who continued that conversation about designated area declarations in Victoria via unpacking a recently released report by the centre called A Tale of Two Cities, The Hidden Geography of Police Powers in Victoria. And now we are going to listen to an interview that Alice conducted earlier this week with writer, independent journalist and anti-fascist activist Tom Tanaki to discuss the Albanese Labor government's combating anti-Semitism laws, much of which have passed both houses of parliament earlier this week. Now, civil society organisations and legal advocates have raised alarm about the speed at which these laws have been rushed through Parliament, with consultation on the exposure draft of the Combating Anti-Semitism, Hate and Extremism Bill 2026 announced on the 13th of January this year in the wake of the Bondi attack. And we'll also have a link in our show notes to a video that Tom did unpacking the hate speech laws. But for now, let's listen to that interview with Tom Tanaki.
I was wondering if you could just sort of, for the listeners, just sort of explain what's been happening over the last few months in regards to these hate speech laws.
Yes. Well, I suppose for me, historically, the passage of these laws from policy recommendations into where they are now, I say it began life from series of policy recommendations made by the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. They made 13 policies for reform, which if you have a look, it was some time ago they were made now, but if you have a look at them, you can see some striking similarities to the law that came in. And the reason that's the case is because someone who used to lead the Executive Council of Australian Jewry was Gillian Siegel, who later went on to be the Special Envoy to Combat Anti-Semitism. So naturally, she took their work wholesale, being as she ascribes to the same kind of like ultra-Zionist politics that they do. When she was put into place by government, appointed, she more or less lifted most of those points and made them her report on combating anti-Semitism, which, you know, we all saw last year. A lot of us, you know, I made a video about, you know, going through those changes and also wrote for Independent Australia about them. I thought that a lot of them were sort of borderline fascist in nature. I thought these, well, let me say, authoritarian in nature. Mm. You know, the demands they made on migration really centred around, you know, policing, you know, the pro-Palestinian movement. Really, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty transparent.
That's ultimately what they were about doing. And the measures they were calling for were just, yeah, out and out, to my mind, authoritarian. Not just to my mind, to many others as well. Well, we did have part of those recommendations implemented. We had the IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism, which is known for blending or blurring the lines between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. We did have that instated as law in some respects by the Australian government, but a lot of those policy proposals were rubbished, you know, and I think the Albanese government shied away from them all based on the response. But then Bondi happened.
Yeah.
And after the Bondi tragedy, as we'd all be aware, as your audience would be aware, a lot of that tragedy was turned fairly quickly by the those in power.
Yeah, used for political purposes.
It was used for political ends, yeah. And so suddenly there was an immediate appetite to introduce those laws, introduce those reforms. And a lot of those policy proposals came up in the form of the Combating Anti-Semitism, Hate and Extremism Bill 2026. Which it does a series of things regarding firearms legislation and customs law that I'm not, you know, there's no need to hear what I think about it. I'm not the expert. Laws on firearms, but that's just me. I have no expertise on that. But what I was interested in was,
censorship.
I mean, there's the formal definition of hate crime at the Commonwealth level. There was the intent to create a new aggravated offence, basically an aggravated hate crime offence for people who incite or advocate violence or racial supremacy. So there was like an aggravated hate crime law to be, aggravated racial vilification, I should say, law to be introduced on top of racial vilification stuff introduced in the context of Executive Council of Australian Jewellery lobbying last year. So it was, introducing a more serious crime on top of one that was only just recently introduced, perhaps not even too soon to even see if it had any tangible effect,
How that sort of definition can be, misused in practice because it hasn't really existed yet.
Absolutely. And in particular because anyone who looked over the legislation when it was just in bill form will have noticed that the introduction of a new form of vilification or discrimination, being national discrimination, was inserted all over the relevant law. And that was one of the changes made inside this sort of omnibus bill. And the notion, given the background that I described earlier of the law, the notion of national discrimination, as opposed to ethnic discrimination or racial discrimination, it was a separate category that was being introduced. Well, we all took it to mean that you were talking about discrimination contextually against the nation of Israel. Because what other nation's discrimination are we concerned about? And after all, the bill was called the Combating Anti-Semitism Bill. So obviously we were very concerned about the capacity of this bill to eventually incriminate pro-Palestinian activists.
Yeah.
But more to my area of expertise was the element of the bill that proposed to prescribe groups as a prohibited hate group. And Tony Burke had made it fairly clear that he was intending two groups to be first cabs off the rank, being the NSN, the National Socialist Network, and Hizbut Tahrir, the sort of fundamentalist Islamic political/ caliphate aims group. And they were aiming to do that, and along with once you're prescribed as a hate group, which, by the way, a lot of people's concern was the fact that this could occur without anyone's discretion but Tony Burke. I mean, as the AFP minister, it was basically completely up to him.
So, oversight, no trial.
No procedural fairness, no nothing, no checks and balances, basically.
Yeah.
And which again, other people, other stripes of activists, more tangible ones, more realistic ones, like, those of us who've been part of the anti-genocide movement, were deeply concerned that this could be leveraged against us. Well,
any group against the state.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there was definitely, and then there was a raft of quite vague, penalties for people who were members of the group, but not just members of the group that, was to be prescribed, but people interested in membering the group, people who had made steps towards joining the group, people who'd recruited for the group, at recruits to the group, people who trained with the group.
Yes,
and so all in all, given that there were a series of penalties of different, you know, sort of level, but I looked at it, and when I sort of looked at it all up, when I considered that NSN members all training with the group, physical combat training is what all of them do. It's their main activity that they do together. And I surmised that all of them would basically end up in jail for 15 years, even the new recruits.
Mm.
And I didn't like it because I've never really appreciated the creep of authoritarian laws to deal with the fringe far right. I've always made the argument that more laws and bans and cops and such do not get rid of the far right. In fact, they accelerate the circumstances that lead to the kind of discontent that sends people towards groups like the National Socialist Network. And we've seen that in practice. We've seen that in practice with the SIGHAL bans and the SIMBOL bans. They have been utilised by them to basically turn themselves into a weekly tabloid appearance.
Mm.
You know, the difference between now and 2020 is that the NSN enjoy weekly coverage by the Australian mainstream media. And every time it's happened, they've received new recruits,
yeah.
You know. And so they've just become this mainstay of tabloid media and the mainstream press, and it's always funneled new people through to them. And by virtue of that, since those laws got introduced, they've exploded in size. You know, the conditions have just led to them. You know, you've had NSN members appear like, you know, embattled castle-style everyman in the press because they're taking their SIGHAL trial all the way to the High Court, and it's all just led to benefit them.
And it's just the perfect mythology for recruiting disaffected, you know, young boys, you know, like he's this warrior, you know, he's being suppressed. He needs your help.
100%. 100%. And it's where their conspiracies began to meet reality because by the end of it, after all the laws, they really were being repressed,
you know,
quite significantly so. And so they were starting to look like the everyman.
Yeah.
They should never have been framed as, but, you know, reality started to make their conspiracies, and this is what stood to benefit them so much.
Yeah.
But they understand the lay of the land, and when they saw that this bill was coming into place, they declared that they would be immediately disbanding as of last Sunday night, just before Parliament was gathering, recall to discuss these bills. And, NSN's leader, Thomas Steele, did that because he knows... He knew what was on the horizon for the group, you know.
Yeah.
If you look at what happened over in the UK, the prescription of the terrorist prescription of the group National Action, they, after that happened to them, former members who gathered in groups of more than two, many of them ended up in jail, even if they weren't going, you know. So these were Nazis were hanging out together because they'd just spent years hanging out together under the auspices of that group, and that was being used as criterion to send them to jail because that was the argument was that they were still organising. Whether they were or not, I don't know, but that was used as that. One of them was found to have symbols from the group in their bedroom, you know, because they used to be a member and they hadn't destroyed them when the prescription happened. They were sent to jail. And this happened to many of their members. You could see that we'd introduced even more stringent laws than the UK had. And so he said, right, that's it, we're all disbanding. And indeed, with bipartisan agreement between Liberal and Labor, and really apart from eliminating the racial vilification element, the law's the same, you know. Libs haven't done much in their emergency seating last night. They didn't do much to change the law. They got rid of the racial vilification element, but substantially the prohibited hate groups element is now agreed to. It's in there. It's a little bit buffed up, but only slightly. And so now that is an act of law. You know, so it's not a bill anymore, it's legislation.
Yeah.
And so the NSN were right to disband when they did. And now we have this law that was intended to be around, I assume, that element of it I thought was meant to be around reducing firearm violence, you know, or reducing fringe hate group violence. And yet we have hundreds of young men who are now lone wolves, if you will.
Yeah.
And they have nothing to support them because they were in a cult after all, and that's how I see it, you know. I don't have any sympathy for their political position, as neo-Nazis, of course, but they were radicalized and groomed,
yeah,
most of them being very young men, some of them under 18, into a cult. And none of the resources to de-radicalize them actually exist, despite many of us, families, anti-fascists like myself, experts, having called for peer support initiatives to help these people in
like
their
deprogramming.
Families.
Like
that's
active.
Right, exactly, yeah. Yeah. None of that has been funded for
because,
at all.
Well, at this point, it's sort of just like the cockroaches are fleeing under the fridge. They're not going anywhere. They're still going to be making groups. They're still going to be grooming children online, you know, converting, like, you know, pushing them towards this cult.
Yeah.
It'll just have a different name, right?
Yeah. Like, well, here's the thing. The legislation actually caters to the fact, or it accommodates the fact that alternative names can occur for substantially the same group. And that's completely up to Tony Burke's discretion as well. So the NSN, groups of people who made up the NSN really can't get together and make a new group with a different name.
Okay.
If it's seen after this prescription that it's substantially similar, which will be completely up to Tony, then they'll be able to add that name to the list without anyone else's say-so. So really, it's over for the NSN. And this is why Stu has been saying that to all of his members. He's been saying scatter, you know, scatter.
Yeah.
Don't associate with each other in groups of any more than two anymore. And he's right to say that. He can see what's on the horizon. But here's the thing. I think about someone else who saw their movement, their time in the sun, scatter in 2017. Brenton Tarrant. And he had exactly the same political literacy or radical neo-Nazi political education as these kids. And when his movement in 2017, the Patriot movement, scattered to the wind, he went on to make other plans as a lone wolf. And what do we all think's going to happen with all these young men now?
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And this is why none of the funding has been allocated to any of this. So as far as I'm concerned, we are now in perhaps the most dangerous era of all for, you know, the kind of lone wolf kind of act that Mike Burgess, you know, not to mention people who know more than him, like anti-fascists, have always been talking about. A warning can happen when you allow groups like this to grow for so long. It's a really dangerous time, and it's happened as a result of these hasty, rushed authoritarian laws, you know?
Yeah. And it really does just, I mean, so many of these right-wing violent attacks are already lone wolves. That's all, you know, so it's just going to increase their intensity, really.
Yeah.
Without addressing how to actually, you know, not to get into the material concerns that are leading to these people, that's a whole different, you know, segment. But
yeah. But you know, yeah, as you're alluding to, you know, there are grassroots, not to mention grassroots, but there are peer support things you can do to help people who are trying to extricate their loved one who was just in a radical cult out of that situation. And none of that infrastructure exists. And so now you have hundreds of families of hundreds of these lone wolves, sorry to continue to use that word, but you know what I mean, and they're completely abandoned because the only de-radicalisation options that existed before were police-funded ones, if you've already been charged with something. Well, what about all these kids? They haven't been charged with anything yet, so they can't access those programs. Nothing exists for them. And now what are they going to do? Well, I'm scared that all it takes is 1-2% of them to go on and consider doing what Tarrant did. That's all it takes. And they all venerated Tarrant. They were taught to venerate him.
Mm.
And now they've lost their group that was, for many of them, the only thing keeping them anchored to reality. As disgusting as the NSN always was, it kept them training. It kept them meeting people. They can't do that anymore. They've just been told they can't do it, otherwise they go to jail.
Yeah,
I'm scared about what that means. And that's all thanks to these anti-hate laws. Thank you very much.
And the, you know, it reinforces the mythos that they were brainwashed with, that they are part of a persecuted little group. And this is the time to do that. You know, it's really just...
Yeah. The accelerationists, the cause of the accelerationists, and this is really what anything were, accelerationists hoping to, by their very existence, accelerate the dissolution, the dismantlement of civil society. I mean, well, these laws, if they lead to more violence, that will do the same thing. So all dreams will essentially be met if that's the case.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to have to wrap us up there. We're getting to the end of the segment time. Thank you so much for joining me today, Tom.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where can people get in contact with you or find your work?
I'm on most of the big tech social media platforms. Well, more fool me. You can find me on Instagram. I'm regularly on there. I do regular videos on YouTube. And I write fortnightly columns in Independent Australia. My upcoming article, which will be out on Saturday, will be about this very subject matter, obviously. If you decide you love my stuff, I've always got a little Patreon, but that's only optional. At the end of the day, I do my work as an anti-fascist, hopefully for the public good. So find me on any of those platforms.
And that was Tom Tanaki, writer, independent journalist and anti-fascist activist, speaking with Alice about the Albanese Labor government's combating anti-Semitism laws, much of which have passed both houses of parliament early this week. And Tom spoke about the impact in particular on the far right, on the National Socialist Network and other fascist groups, and concerns about the way that legislative crackdowns actually feeds into the persecution complex of these groups. It might lead to some serious consequences that lawmakers have predictably not paid attention to, as well as the fact that these hate speech laws raise serious concerns about people who are raising their voices about real injustices, including the genocide of Palestinians. You are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is just coming up on 8:11 in the morning. We're going to head to a song now. This is Bart Willoughby's classic, We Have Survived.
Yes. convention, genocide prevention, trace crime scene.
Monday, the 26th of January, marks Invasion Day, and 3CR's First Nations broadcast team will be bringing an annual Invasion Day broadcast to the airwaves from 10 a.m.
In 1788, down Sydney Cove, first boat people land, and they say, "Sorry, boys, I gained your loss. We're gonna steal your land."
Our team will be broadcasting speeches from the NAM rally and conversations with people attending the march, as well as connecting with Aboriginal activists from across the continent at the forefront of campaigns for land rights, restoration, restitution and real treaties, and learning about the way it may be done. And of course, we'll be playing deadly music from our incredible black artists, past and present. So keep it tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m, 3CR Digital, 3cr.org.au streaming live on Monday the 26th of January from 10 a.m.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. It is 8:16 in the morning, and you just heard an incredible rendition of We Have Survived featuring Uncle Robbie Thorpe and a beautiful musical composition. Now, I did want to just play a speech by Paul Silva, who is a Dungari man, an activist and the nephew of David Dungar Jr., speaking on the 18th of January on Sunday at a rally to commemorate 10 years since David Dungar Jr. passed away in the custody of New South Wales Corrective Services. And this rally was met with a significant police presence, with attendees prevented from taking to the streets by New South Wales police due to new powers to restrict public protests granted after the Bondi attack in December 2025. Now, this speech was recorded by Ingaranathan Selvaratnam, and I am going to play it now.
Pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging for their resistance for 238 years up against this colonial system known as Australia. Their resilience and their fight and their presence doesn't go unknown for me as a young First Nations man. And before I start, I just want to take a minute silence to remember all the Aboriginal people that have had their lives taken by this corrupt system without any justice and accountability. So if we can please raise our fists and bow our heads for the voiceless that can't be here with us today, please let's do that.
Thank you. We now sit on over 615 Aboriginal deaths in custody since the 1991 Royal Commission. Yay! With no justice and real accountability for the families involved. I've been on the front line for the past decade since my uncle was tragically taken and brutally taken by this system. Yay! Throughout my fight, I've stood alongside many families. I've witnessed the evidence of their loved ones being taken by this brutal system. And then I've sat there, and despite those evidence, I've seen the families have no justice and or accountability. Yay! For me as a young person, it's important that not only me, but other First Nations people and non-Indigenous people realise that Aboriginal deaths in custody is one of the main forms of killing and unaliving our people today in 2026. Yay! Even when you have racist white people running our people down in the streets in the Northern Territory and getting no real justice or accountability for their families, the system continuously allows it. Yay! Now we come up against New South Wales Police, New South Wales Government, implementing protest laws, trying to silence movements, trying to silence our freedom of speech, whether that be Indigenous movements or whether that be any other movements. We have a right to congregate, we have a right to protest, we have a right to rally. The extension of the New South Wales protest laws had only affected one protest, and that's a protest we're here for today.
Yay!
What we see is advocates like myself. I'm not an advocate, that's what they titled me to be. I'm a grieving nephew that lost an uncle that won't give up fighting for the justice and accountability he deserves. Yeah. So the title of an advocate, that can stay, but the truth be the truth. And I'm here to fight for my uncle, for everyone else that I've witnessed being taken by this system, being brutalised, and even in today's day and age in society, the way that the system treats First Nations people and even middle-class citizen Australians, if you want to call yourselves that, is completely and utterly disgusting. As an advocate for deaths in custody, I don't dispute that non-Indigenous people suffer the same consequences. I don't dispute that white people lose their lives at the hands of the system or any other person that shares these lands as Australia. I don't dispute that. But what we must know is that Aboriginal people are at the very top of that list. Aboriginal people at the very top of that target list.
Yay!
This Australian government that works today got orders 238 years ago to wipe First Nations people off the face of the earth. Yay! They do that in the forms of deaths in custody, forced removal of our children, destructions of sacred sites, medical healthcare negligence causing death, systematic racism causing people to take their own lives, and the tremendous pressure of oppression in 2026 that First Nations people can't even walk around in society without being frowned upon, without being looked down upon. I'll continue to stand not just for my uncle and why we're here today, not just for the 600 and 15 plus Aboriginal deaths in custody that occurred, but for the next generation to come, and for the generations to come after those. Because it's important for me, as a First Nations man, and I am obligated to ensure that our culture and our resistance continues for 238,000 years to come. Because the reality of it is, we have been the only ones constantly at this government for 238 years. We are the sovereign people of this land, and we have not stopped calling out the corruption. Leading up to January 26, I want people to know it's important to stand with First Nations people. It's important to stand in 100% solidarity. Stand with the First Nations people January 26. Fly our flags, wear our shirts, and say that this always was and always will be. Always was and always will be. Thank you. So we stand here today.
You are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and you just heard a speech by Paul Silva, who is a Dungati man and the nephew of David Dungai Jr., who passed away in the custody of New South Wales Corrective Services. Whoop. Hey, don't mind me, who passed away in the custody of New South Wales Corrective Services 10 years ago on Sunday, the 18th of January. Now, that speech was given at a rally at Hyde Park, which was quite heavily policed by the New South Wales Police Force, with attendees prevented from taking to the streets by New South Wales Police due to new powers that had been put in place to restrict public protests that were granted after the Bondi attack in December 2025. We had hoped to have Paul join us live on air today, but unfortunately he wasn't available. But it is very important to keep an eye on what is going on in New South Wales. There has been a special carve out, a last minute exemption to New South Wales' increasingly draconian protest laws that have supposedly facilitated the conduct of the Invasion Day rally as usual this year. But we encourage people to keep eyes on Sydney and on the Invasion Day rally in Sydney to see what is happening. The planned route has been carved out by of the area restricting protests in a new declaration by New South Wales Police Commissioner Mal Lanyon, as reported by Black Caucus, who are organizing the march. So it is supposed to proceed without any threat of arrest by police. And this is a very important victory for the Black Caucus, who refused to back down from their original plans for Invasion Day, despite significant pressure from government and from the police. And the Black Caucus is also calling on the Minns government to lift all restrictions on protest. So, again, you know, we're seeing these crackdowns, these restrictions on protests, and the way that they are impacting, in particular, First Nations organizers and Palestine solidarity protests in Victoria, in New South Wales, around the country. And I think today's show has really been tied together by that theme of ongoing resistance and the importance of calling out injustice, while also acknowledging the fact that these draconian crackdowns are continuing. So just to give you a recap of what we covered today, we were first joined by Tarni and Onus Brown, who's Guna Jamara, Yorta Yorta Bindle, and Miriam Person, and community organizer. And they spoke with us about the ongoing federal court challenge against Victoria Police's designated areas powers in the context of First Nations resistance movements. Now, this is a case brought by Human Rights Law Centre on behalf of Tarneen, Benny Zabel, and with new applicant David Hack. And it questions the validity of Victoria Police's extraordinary powers within designated areas, including stop and search powers and the ability to direct people to leave areas if they refuse to remove a face covering. And as Tarneen mentioned in the interview, they are asking people, organizers are asking people who are coming to Invasion Day to register via the Humanitix so that they can receive medical and legal updates, and also to head to Dajawa Foundation to support with donation collections. And we'll have links to both in our show notes. And then after that, we were joined by Ilo Diaz from the Center Against Racial Profiling to talk about A Tale of Two Cities, the hidden geography of police powers in Victoria. And we then heard an interview where Alice caught up with Tom Tanaki to discuss the Albanese Labor government's combating anti-Semitism laws and their significant impacts on fascist groups, but also on anti-fascist groups and people calling out the genocide in Palestine. And then finally, as you just heard, we played a speech by Dungari activist Paul Silver, nephew of David Dungari Jr., that was at a rally held last Sunday, the 18th of January, to commemorate 10 years since David Dungari Jr.'s passing in custody of New South Wales Corrective Services. And credit to Ingaranathan Selvaratnam for that recording. Thank you so much for posting that publicly. We really appreciate all of the work of people doing independent recordings and making this available for everyone so that we continue to circulate these really important messages. We will catch you later on Thursday Breakfast, and have a good weekend.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.